Thank you. It's a beautiful day. I mean, it's actually beautiful out there. You know, I am so spoiled. I grew up in Pennsylvania, spent all my life in Pennsylvania until the last 4 years in down Florida. And after about 3 months in Florida, I became an absolute wimp to cold air. And any time I have to go anywhere north, and for me, you know, like Gainesville is the north. And I just happened to mention Gainesville. I probably shouldn't have, so I'm sorry. But I just get a little nervous if I'm going north that I'm going to freeze. And to see sunshine and warmth was great. So I didn't have to bring my winter jacket after all, or my coat, scarves, gloves, and hat after all. So that was very helpful. And it's a beautiful night, and you're a college student, and you're not out there. So I just want to say thank you for being in here. It's very kind of you. I've been given a difficult topic, Can We Trust an Imperfect Church? And as I understood what my topic was more specifically within that is a little bit of church history. And there's a lot of carnage in the wake of church history. There's a lot of imperfection in church history. But I was thinking about this, and I had a colleague who used to chide me because I mostly teach church history. But I had an Old Testament colleague who used to say to me, well, you know, church history really begins in Genesis chapter 1. So really, we talk about church history, we can talk about biblical history. If we have wreckage and carnage through the centuries of the church, let's just go to the pages of Scripture itself. And let's see all these imperfect people. I did some children's books. Did a one called Church History ABCs and the Reformation ABCs. You see the theme here? And so I'm working on one like right now. I wrote a couple pages on the way up here on Bible History ABCs. And just sort of a biblical, theological, working through the Bible. And not just being sort of how some traditional kids' books approach the biblical story, but thinking about it along biblical theological lines. But anyway, as you get into this, and you have certain pages, so I have the page on Abraham, and you begin to think, well, how much of the story of Abraham and Sarah do I want to get in here? Do I really want to talk about, you know, in addition to Isaac, they had another son. And let's talk about where that son came from. No, don't think I want to do that. So we're going to talk about Joshua and the conquest of Canaan. And these are little kids picturing the story in my mind, all ready for bed. Parents are ready to tuck them in. Let's read a few pages of what, of course, is going to become their favorite kids' book of all time. And we're talking about the conquest. And Joshua went in, and he killed them all. And not only did he kill them all, he killed all their animals. Even if they had pets, he put them to death. Not a single living thing was to be left. Do I put that in the story, or do I not put that in the story? And so I want to back this talk up to Scripture itself. Because there is something that we learn there as we go through this story that will help us understand that if we're looking for a perfect church, we're probably asking the wrong question. And if we're judging church history on a history of imperfect church, we're probably judging it according to the wrong standard. And so if we go back to the biblical picture, what do we find? We find a history of imperfect people. And not just that these are imperfect people. I mean, these are some scoundrels that we find. And they're not just outliers to the biblical narrative. They're essential to it. They're sort of pivot points that move God's plan of redeeming a people for himself. And it's these people. It's Abraham with his conniving ways of sometimes passing his wife off as his sister because that's more expedient for him. Or of having a son with Hagar, which culturally was perfectly acceptable. That was a perfectly acceptable cultural practice because Abraham was unable to have an heir and he had this huge estate and was a man of means and wealth. And he needed an heir. It's a perfectly cultural, acceptable thing for there to be a surrogate that would provide an heir. But it wasn't God's plan for Abraham, and there was a lot of carnage. I mean, just even before Isaac comes on the scene, even before Ishmael grows up, there's carnage between Hagar and Sarah within the household of Abraham. And that's just a foreshadow and a taste of what's going to come of the strife between the two sons and then the peoples that descend from Ishmael and from Isaac. I mean, we read about it now as a result of Abraham's weakness and Abraham's sin. David is going to be a page. He has to be. King David is going to be the K page. Do we talk about Bathsheba? I don't know. So there was this, when we went to this church up in Pennsylvania when we lived up there, and they would have a children's bulletin. So they had a worship bulletin for the adults, but they'd have a kid's bulletin. And it would be a little bit, it'd follow the order of the service, but it would have a little bit different things in it for them, and it would have some things for them to do. And the cover of it was always artwork that was done by a kid in the church. And so it would have the artwork of some biblical theme and, you know, the person's kid's first name and their age. And so my son, this nice young lady's back there, her older brother. So, and don't worry about overwhelming her. She's had two older brothers. She can handle pretty much anything. But my son says to me, I want to draw a picture for the church bulletin. I'm like, great, knock yourself out. He disappears for an hour or so, emerges back, hands me the picture. And I'm like, oh, I think I know what this is, but why don't you tell me what I'm looking at? It's a picture of David, King David, on, you know, the side of his castle, and he's looking out, and there's a rooftop, and on the rooftop is a stick figure lying down, and David has a big smile on his face. And I just thought, I don't think I can submit this to the church for the bulletin. But, you know, he read the story, and that was the story. These aren't marginal figures. These are not only leaders and pivotal figures in the history of redemption. These are biblical authors. I mean, these are human beings who write the Bible. And then I read this event. I just looked over it again this afternoon. It's chilling. Every time I read this, it just sends chills up and down my spine. When Peter's with Jesus, and Jesus says, "Oh, Peter, Satan desires to sift you like wheat." And what does Peter do, right? Oh, I will stand by you, right? And he says, "You're going to deny me." And then what does Jesus say to him? And then you will turn. You should look at this. Go back and look this up in Luke. Somewhere in Luke, I forget the chapter. My favorite verse in all the Bible is in Hebrews, where the author of Hebrews says, "Somewhere it says." I just love that. So if I can't remember a chapter and verse, "Somewhere it says" is good enough for the author of Hebrews. I don't even know where in Hebrews that is. Somewhere in Hebrews it says, "Somewhere it says." So somewhere in Luke it says, "You'll do this, and then you'll turn, and then I will build my church on you." So we're talking about we're not going to look at this from a Roman Catholic perspective. I disagree with the Roman Catholic understanding there of the role of Peter, and then even more so of the apostolic, so-called apostolic succession that comes from Peter. So we're not going to go that route. But there is something significant to what Jesus is saying there, not just about Peter's pronouncement, but about Peter, the person. And as Acts unfolds, Peter is pivotal to this new moment in redemptive history, and he is pivotal in the building of the church. He's the figure from Acts 2 until Acts 9, and Paul comes onto the scene. But in those early moments, Peter is the leader. He's the one who stands up at the day of Pentecost. and he's imperfect. So when we come into looking at church history, we have to see us coming out of the pages of Scripture where the people that God has used in pivotal, crucial ways, even the people that he used to be the human instruments in the giving of his revelation to us, these have been imperfect people. Now, I think there's a reason for that, and we're going to sort of put that in a little dock, and we're going to come back to that, why there's a reason for that. But let's now get into the topic proper of church history. So what are the big usual suspects when we get into this issue of an imperfect history? Say some events. The Crusades. So big, in fact, it sort of pushes up. Did someone say Inquisition? No one suspects the Inquisition. The Inquisition. Now, that's fine. I won't lay claim to that because that's in another stream of the Christian tradition that I don't claim to belong to. So I'll gladly talk about the Inquisition, but it's not something I've... These are not my people, so I don't need to worry about that too much. The Hundred Years' War, when you talk about this great event of the Reformation, what does it do? It leaves Europe in decades of war. In fact, that's a very common argument of the so-called new atheists, that when you have a sort of religious fervor, it leads to bloodshed and battle and war. And whether it's the Crusades or whether it's the aftermath of the Reformation, or whether it's even this idea of Christians conquering native peoples around the globe and, you know, taking with them all of their germs and diseases and wiping out whole populations of native people. Whatever it is, it's a common argument to say that in this name of a conquesting Christianity, there are a lot that are on the receiving end of that in a very negative, impactful way. I think the thing we need to recognize here is that as we look at these episodes in church history, two things come to mind. Number one, it doesn't do us any service to ignore them. So I think we have to acknowledge that even though I want to put some distance, whoever raised the Inquisition, I want to put some distance between myself and those of the Spanish Inquisition, we have to recognize that even in our own camp, and closer to our own camp, we have these issues. This was brought home to me. I remember one time, just to tell you a little bit about why I was destined to be a church historian. So in my college dorm, I had a picture of Martin Luther in my dorm room in college. And I had, these days, colleges are like luxury penthouse apartments, college dorms. But in those days, it was, you know, two-door room, bathroom in the middle, two-door room. And in the room over next to us, the two there were Russians. They were Jewish Russians that were in that dorm. And very offended. First time I walked into my room, saw the Luther picture, said something in Russian. Probably a good thing that I don't speak Russian to know exactly what he said when he saw the picture. But it was very offensive to him. And I was like, shocked. Oh, what do you mean? This is Martin Luther. We owe him everything. Why would you? So, very insensitive, you know, on my part. When I lived up in Lancaster, and for 6 years I was a township supervisor. Any of you from Pennsylvania? No one is from Pennsylvania? Someone's from Maryland. That's close enough. You know, Pennsylvania is a commonwealth. Is South Carolina a commonwealth or a state? It's a state, right? State. Pennsylvania's a commonwealth. Everything's on local government levels. So I was a township supervisor for 6 years up in Pennsylvania. We ran a campaign. I raised money. I was going to lower taxes and bring, you know, freedom to everybody. Anyway, there's a lot of Amish. It was all Amish. It was 80% ag in this township. And I'd always have to go to their farms for issues, you know. And I had this Luther t-shirt. And I would always have to remember not to wear the Luther t-shirt when I go to the Amish farms because, you know, Luther put to death some of their ancestors. So I needed to make sure that I wasn't communicating that message. So some of these things hit, we can say, well, that's not us. That's a different stream. But some of them do hit close to home. And so what we have to do right up front is say they were wrong. It's the first thing we have to do. We have to acknowledge it, and we have to say they were wrong. They were wrong. Now, we can go back to Luther. We can say, well, have you really understood what Luther actually thought about the Jews? Because here's what Luther did, his full thought about the Jews. And I think someone's going to talk about the Reformation, so my hunch is that this is going to come up in earnest there. So I'll sort of back off a little bit. But when you think about, when you look at it, you have to say there is a context to this. There's a complexity to this. And very often we don't look into the complexity of it or the context of it. So while we are saying this is wrong, we also have to sort of get past a surface sort of understanding of it and really try to dig in and really try to understand, first of all, the full context of what was going on there, and then the full complexity of what's going on there. But the second thing, and this takes us back now to the biblical story. So I said, let's put that in the dock. Let's take it out of the dock. There's a reason why there's an imperfect church. And there's a reason why all of these biblical heroes come to us. And when we finally get out of the kids' books that don't have the pictures with warts and all, and we dig into the biblical narrative and we see the warts and all, there's a reason. It has to do with this promise in Genesis 3:15. If we go back to Genesis 3:15, we have this, the fall of Adam and Eve. And we have the promise that there will be a seed to come. Now on the surface of it, if you just look at Genesis 3:15, there's a lot in there, but there's also not a lot in there. What does it say? It says that you will have this seed, and there's the serpent. So now we're picturing a contest, as it were, setting the stage for a context. Every good story has conflict. Now we have the conflict. We have the seed and the serpent. And what is going to happen here? The serpent is going to bite the heel of the seed. But what is the seed going to do? It's going to crush the head of the serpent. Now, there are Old Testament scholars who will tell you the essence of that text is this. That explains why people do not get along well with snakes. Now, part of me wants to believe that, because every time I see a snake, I hate snakes. I hate them. I just want to kill them. If they're anywhere around me, I just want to go get something, I want to kill it. We have these little black racer snakes all over in Florida. They're harmless as can be. My daughter loves them. She catches them, making pets. I want to kill them. If I see them, I just want to kill them. If I'm on a tractor and I see mowing the yard, I see a snake, I'm going after it. I don't care. I've turned the Daytona 500 curve, you know, and I'm going after it. That's not what this text is about. If we move on in the biblical story, we find out that this text is about the seed to come, the Messiah. It's about Christ. But you have to go back to the Genesis narrative. Because what happens? Adam and Eve turn on each other, and then Cain turns around and kills Abel. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and we do need to talk about him, because for every stories of imperfect Christians out there, we've got to put up the stories of those very heroic Christians to counter some of these arguments that come at us. Dietrich Bonhoeffer called this he said it's not a fallen world. It's a fallen, falling world. And if you know anything, anybody study German here? German speakers? Anybody majoring in German? Minoring in German? Took German, met a German once. Okay, good. So Germans just put words together. That's what they do. They just put words together. They invent new words. They just add words. That's what Bonhoeffer did. He just put two words together. Fallen, put a hyphen, falling. But that's the world we live in. It's not just a fallen world. It's that we have fallen people living in a fallen world. And sin is not an issue of addition. It's an issue of multiplication. And we see that. Adam and Eve turn on each other, and there's a bitterness there where there was always peace and harmony. But then Cain turns around and kills his brother. And then this beautiful thing happens in the biblical narrative. A seed is given. Another son is given. Seth is given. And Eve says a very tender thing. She sees Seth as a gift from God to counterbalance this curse and this activity. And what is she thinking? The serpent is going to bite the heel, but the seed will crush the head of the serpent. Is Seth the seed who will deliver us? Turns out Seth is not the seed. We know Seth is not the seed because Seth dies. Which is interesting. Those boring parts in the Old Testament where everybody's dying, there's a reason that's there. It's telling us, nope, not the seed. How about this person? They lived a long time. Nope, not the seed. Because they all die. They all die. And not only do they all die, but they all mess up. Noah, he has to be the seed who's going to deliver us. Well, what an incredibly shameful thing Noah does after the flood. There should be a warning label on the Noah narrative of what's coming here. And then we go to the judges. Are these the seed who's going to deliver? And they all show their imperfections, glaring imperfections. And I skipped over Moses. We go back to Moses. Is he the seed? He's called a deliverer. He's going to deliver people. And then we get to the kings. Saul is definitely not the seed. Is David the seed? Does this heinous act of adultery? And then, what did we learn from Richard Nixon? It's never the crime. It's always the cover-up. And not only does David do this horrible thing of adultery, but it's in the cover-up where the wheels really fall off the wagon and he essentially commits murder. And very clear, he's not the seed. In fact, he's told as much. And then comes Solomon. He's not the seed. And then the rest of the kings, you might as well just give up on them. There's only a few that are good. So we're seeing this picture, aren't we? And the idea here is the same idea once we get to the New Testament with these figures in church history, or figures in biblical history, rather. They're imperfect because they point us past themselves. The church was never to look to Peter. The church was never to think that somehow Peter had some special position, that he was now perfect, that he could think so clearly. Think about this. Now, this doctrine developed over time in the Roman Catholic Church, papal infallibility, over a lot of time. But the seeds of it were there. But for papal infallibility to work, this is what you're saying. This human person thinks absolutely clearly and perfectly about an issue, that by the time they open their mouth on the issue, what they're saying is absolute truth for all time. That's what is required to have papal authority. Nowhere in the biblical narrative, in the epistles, nowhere are we commanded to look to a human being as having ultimate, eternal, abiding authority, and so we should then look to them to hear their word. It's the opposite. And so we have these imperfect people in the biblical narrative because they're pointing ahead that they're not the seed. And don't look to them to be the seed who's going to deliver us. And then once the seed does come and Christ builds his church, what do we have in the biblical narrative as it unfolds in the other direction? From Christ out, right? We don't have people who are put up as the authority. They are pointing In fact, this is the whole point of apostolic authority. That the apostles teach exactly what Jesus said, nothing more, and certainly nothing less. And when Jesus is with the disciples in that final moment, in those chapters of John 14, 15, 16, when he tells them he's leaving them, and they go into this anxiety attack, and he assures them that he's going to prepare a place for them, then he assures them that he's sending the Holy Spirit. And then what does Jesus say to the apostles? And he will bring to your mind all things, everything that I have taught you. And we see there the specific promise of Christ in the scripture itself, ensuring that this group, this apostolic group, will record then a perfect witness to the words and works and understand the words and works of Jesus as we have in the epistles. Wasn't there authority? And isn't this what Paul says when he's fighting with the Corinthians? He's not at all the categories of a Roman leader. He's the exact opposite. Rome prized the physical body. It prized physical strength, prized physical beauty, prized all those things. Paul is the opposite of the spectrum on all that stuff. He has none of that stuff. And this put him at odds, and this made him an easy target for his opponents. And Paul is just mired in this stuff in Corinthians. And when he's trying to make his case in Corinthians, why does he say you should listen to me? Because I speak on Christ's authority. Because Christ called me and Christ made me an apostle. Paul does not appeal to his own authority. His authority is a borrowed, derived authority from the authority of Christ. So, whether it's in the Old Testament or it's in the New Testament, we should expect to see these imperfect people. And we were never told we should see perfect people. And we were never told we would see a perfect church. So when we move into church history and we don't see a perfect church, to cry foul is ultimately not all that legitimate. Because it's just representing what the biblical story is representing, that all of this points us to Christ. And all of this forces us to have some humility. You know, it's very easy to say, boy, in the Middle Ages they blew it, in the Reformation they blew it, in the early church they blew it, this particular historical figure blew it, this particular historical figure blew it, but we have no blind spots. Are we fully aware what is a next generation, what are they going to say about us 500 years from now? Can't believe they did X, they weren't even aware they were doing it. Right? So, to have a little humility as we judge these things and as we view these things goes a long way. To always be reminded that we need to look to Christ and not expect to find perfection. But to look to Christ goes a long way. And I think there's another piece to this, and it has to be this sort of recognition that when these things happen, like let's take a look at it from this vantage point. If we go historically and we go to the Crusades and we say, well, this was horrible, and not only was it horrible, it has had a ripple effect that has been horrible. And we're dealing with some of that now because you have this sort of reparations, as it were, for what happened in the Crusades. So this is a horrible thing. Sometimes it's easier for us to talk about those kinds of things than it is for us to talk about things that hit a little bit closer to home. So it's easier for us to talk about an abusive medieval church. But it's harder for us to talk about a situation in which we personally found ourselves in a church that was not a healthy church. Or we personally found ourselves in a subgroup of Christianity that was not a healthy subgroup of Christianity. And in the name of Christianity, did some rather horrific things or harmful things. It's easier sometimes, I think, to put the question as a platitude level question or as an historical question, when maybe sometimes the motivations behind those kinds of questions is a little bit more existential and a little bit more personal. So what do we do in these kinds of cases? And I suspect you'll have more questions on the issues of history that I have ignored, so feel free to bring those up in the Q&A. But I want to talk about this just for a little bit, and I want to throw it open for questions. What do we do in these cases? So I've known friends. I grew up in a Christian culture. It wasn't a Reformed Christian culture. It was a non-Reformed Christian culture. But even non-Reformed people get it right sometimes. So I grew up in a culture that it wasn't perfect by any stretch. Church culture, it wasn't perfect by any stretch. But understood the gospel. Understood love. Understood forgiveness as crucial to a Christian community. And was not perfect, certainly was not perfect. I would say it was more fundamentalist, you know. This was back in the 70s and 80s, and it was very typical for youth groups back in the 70s and 80s to bring their vinyl rock and roll records and burn them, you know, because rock and roll is of the devil. So that was sort of the culture, and it was also very typical for sort of lore to spread, legend to spread, that when you'd burn these records, you would hear demons in the flames screaming. Of course, it's just plastic, you know, popping. But anyway, if you're 13 and it's night and there's a fire, you're ready to think about anything anyway. So some of you maybe have come from contexts like that, and where that sort of hardline Christianity wasn't just simply burning records. Do you know if they? Okay, vinyls made a comeback, so you know what that is. 8-tracks, so you had to burn 8-track tapes too. But anyway, you come from a context where no, it's much more harmful than that. Here's, I think, a couple of things that need to be said. That's not true Christianity. I did this book on Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and it was the kind of book I always wanted to write, because I just wanted to write a biography of Bonhoeffer. I just thought he was a fascinating figure. But it was also the kind of book that once I started writing it, I didn't like it, because I just felt so inadequate to be writing about this guy. It was like, we just recently had a conference down at Ligonier, and we had Johnny Erickson, and she spoke, and I spoke like 3 hours later, and I'm like, why am I even standing here? I feel like an absolute spiritual pygmy compared to Johnny. So I get into Bonhoeffer and I just feel like I can't do this. So here's what I learned from Bonhoeffer. The church is the church under the cross. And what that means is grace, forgiveness, being forgiven, giving forgiveness is at the essence of what the church is about. And for whatever reason, there's a lot of churches that just don't get that right. So how does Bonhoeffer get there? Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. That's at the cross. On the cross, Jesus is talking about forgiveness. Do you remember the moment when the disciples come to Jesus and they're like, how many times should we forgive? And they think they're super Christians. They always think they're going to impress Jesus. 7 times 7? 70 times? I can't even add that up. What's 7? 497. Could you say forgive? I forgive you. 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 How much time do you have? Because I got like 483 to go. What's he saying there? There's the parable of the master, or the person who owes the debt, and he owes this incredible debt, magnificent debt. It's given to us in a way to just show the enormous debt, and it's written off. And he has a debtor of this petty debt. And in his absolute pettiness, what does he insist on? The debt be paid. And what does Jesus say? To whom much has been forgiven, You must forgive. Like, there's no way around it. For the church to be the church community, it must be a place of forgiveness and people being forgiven and recognizing that. And it must be a place where grace reigns. That's what it means to be a church. It also means to embrace suffering. You know what Bonhoeffer says? Ultimately, suffering has nothing to do with physical suffering. Ultimately. Suffering is ultimately rejection, is what it is. And he has this great line. Jesus came into the world, offered himself to the world, and what did the world do? The world pushed him all the way out of the world and onto a cross. And theologians will talk about the dereliction of Christ. What does that mean? Christ was literally suspended between heaven and earth. Forsaken by God, rejected by man. That's the church under the cross. Rejected people finding each other and recognizing in each other the love of God. That's the church. Now, it's hard for us to get that right. It's hard for us to get that right. Because what do? We read through the epistles, we read through the gospels, we read through the Old Testament. We're reformed, we talk about the three uses of the law. We have commandments. We have requirements. We're reformed. We talk about church discipline. All these are crucial things. They all got to be part of the mix. We have to have obligations and expectations of each other, right? How communities get along. But what is driving all of this? Even you go look at the texts that talk about church discipline. You look at how Jesus dealt with issues. Think of the woman that was caught in adultery and brought to Jesus. How does he handle that? Right? He stresses how utterly humble we must be. And what does Paul say? There but by the grace of God go I. And he talks about this when you're involved in a discipline case. What is the point of the discipline? To restore someone. Right? And there but by the grace of God go I. So these are the essential ingredients. Forgiveness, grace, humility, recognizing that we of all people have been forgiven. We have been forgiven the most enormous debt you could conceive of. We have been forgiven the debt, as my former boss, R.C. Sproul, who has passed back in December, would say, we've been forgiven the debt of cosmic treason. As sinners, we are guilty of cosmic treason. And that has been forgiven of us. Right. So, when we look at this on a historical level, I think there's a reason for it. The reason for it is because we are never to look at our leaders. We are to look to Christ as the head of the church. We are never to look to our leaders as perfect, authoritative figures. We are to look to Christ alone as the perfect, authoritative leader of the church. When we look into the pages of the Bible, we're seeing perfect people. Because they are not the seed. And we're not to put our trust in them. We follow them. God gives them to us. We do not put our ultimate trust in them. We put our ultimate trust in one alone. So that's the reason for that stuff. But when you get into this, what about imperfect churches that maybe some of you even were part of and maybe even some of you suffered from at the hands of, and maybe there's a continuum of that for you. What do you do with all that? You know, again, it's not always the true church that you're seeing. And we've got to come back to what should be the function, what should be the dynamics of a true church. And I think we have biblical warrant to see to be the dynamics of the true church and of a true Christian community. So, I throw all that out there. We covered everywhere from, you know, Adam to the present day. I wish we had time. One of one of those fun books I had to write was out there, Jesus Made in America. It's just all the silly stuff Americans do and the American church does. And I use Jesus as an example. You know, we put him on poker chips. That's my favorite. I saw it on eBay for $2. I had to have it. A Sacred Heart Jesus lucky $20 poker chip. I saw nativity rubber duckies. Like, somebody needs to pay for that. That somebody's got a debt now they've just accrued, and they're going to have a judgment day. That's going to be a special judgment for turning the nativity set into a rubber duckies. So I wish we could get into that, but maybe in the questions we'll get into that. There's a lot of ground we didn't cover. I get that. But hopefully here's some things that that you can think about as you address this question. Can we trust an imperfect church? Yes. Because it's not the imperfect church that we ultimately put our trust in. It's the perfect head of the imperfect church that we put our trust in. And just as you and I are in the process of maturing, and we have a puppy at home. He's soon 5 months. It's hilarious to watch him. You know, he can't even jump up onto things. He trips over himself. We're like that. We're clumsy in our immaturity. And sometimes that clumsiness even veers into just hurting people. But just as you and I are in our immaturity, so the church as a whole is in the process of maturing. And we do not, we can only trust an imperfect church because ultimately we trust the perfect head of the church. And someday, just as we will be, Jonathan Edwards, the American figure, said, has this great line. He says, in heaven we'll be unclogged. We'll be unclogged of our sin. I just picture like this cosmic Drano, like this big thing of Drano that you just drink in it. That's a bad image. Okay, so. But what do those clogs do? Right? They keep us from loving perfectly. And they keep us from showing mercy perfectly. And they keep us from forgiving perfectly. And they keep us from holding each other to obligations healthily, perfectly. And the church is a clogged church. And just as we will be unclogged someday, and in our glorified, perfect bodies, and love with a pure love as we are loved, so someday the church will be perfect too. But it won't be here. And it won't be now. It'll be in heaven. All right. I'm happy to turn it over. Yes.
Hi. Okay. So going back to the whole idea of imperfect churches or like Reformation and such, one thing that's always kind of somewhere between baffled and bothered me is that everybody can read the same book and come to so many different conclusions about how to worship. And you have so many different denominations of Christianity, and that kind of, after listening to you speak, can you make the argument that because people in the Christian church have argued over how to worship and do ministry, that there is no even template in the Bible to make a perfect church? And why would you want even attempt to make a church if you know that it's not going to be perfect?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Totally.
Okay.
So I don't know if you all heard the question, but the issue is this idea of so many different approaches, so many different denominations, and the issue is there even a template in Scripture itself to have a perfect church, and do you want to make a perfect church? So let me offer a distinction between a church that strives to be biblically faithful and a perfect church. So that church that strives to be biblically faithful strives to be biblically faithful theologically, and so we should care about our theology and our confession. But in Presbyterian circles, we adhere to the Westminster Standards. The Westminster Confession, the Shorter Catechism, Larger Catechism, Public Directory of Worship, the Westminster Standards from 17th century, that's our confessional heritage. But we understand the standards as a second order of authority that are reflective of the first order of authority, which is Scripture. So what are we saying there? We're saying that as a Presbyterian church, like this Presbyterian church, I'm a member of a Presbyterian church, as a Presbyterian church, this is how we understand what biblical faithfulness theologically looks like. And then we go into church practice. So that's polity and church government issues, and that's practice of the sacraments and how we practice the Lord's Supper and how we practice baptism. So again, coming from our confessions, we're striving to be biblically faithful. But I am very hesitant to say that Presbyterianism is the only form of church government that is allowed. And if you are not a Presbyterian, then you are heretical and apostate. Right? I'm saying Presbyterianism looks to me to be a very biblical, faithful form of church government. Right? So I think somewhere, whether it's theology or church practice, I think we need to make a distinction between we are striving to be biblically faithful, but we're not assuming that we are perfect. Now, there are folks in Presbyterianism, just as there are folks in Catholicism or in baptism, who say, no, this is the perfect and pure church, and everyone else is imperfect. Vatican II calls all Protestants separated brethren, meaning the Mother Church is right, and everyone needs to conform to Mother Church. Protestants actually tend to be not that. They tend to say, we get it, Scripture, and we hope to be faithful, Lord. So I'm veering. I think there's a distinction between striving to be biblically faithful and saying we're perfect. And then I think that will give us some humility. So if I think that I have nothing to learn from other denominations or other Christians that think differently than me, I don't see that as humility. I can still say, hold to my, and I have many like Baptist friends, but I hold to my Presbyterian convictions. But they hold to their Baptist convictions, and I respect them, and I like talking to them about things. So I don't know if that helps or not. But I'd say biblically faithful is different than perfect. And I think as long as we are imperfect people, we will always read the Bible not perfectly. We should strive to read it and interpret it as faithfully as we possibly can. But I think the Bible is inerrant. My interpretation is not. And I should be a little careful. If that helps. Yes. Front row questions. I love it. You can ask a question if you're not in the front row. I will let you.
What would be your opinion, or I guess, how would you explain the church's failing to recognize that Christians are imperfect and different communities, impoverished areas?
Yes.
With how government roles fit with that in terms of care of them? And then after that, what is the renewed version of that? Or the renewed version of that?
That's a great question. And I think that's a question that means a lot to you. And I would say that's probably a question that has been asked more acutely recently, especially in American Christianity, than in times past. So let me just say, great question. I would encourage you to think well and deeply as you continue to yourself try to answer that question. So now let's try to answer it. I think there is an obligation on the church to recognize that we have an obligation to the poor. If you go through the biblical text, especially whether it's the Old Testament or the New Testament, you will trip over references of caring for the poor as essential to a marker of God's people. When God is upset at Israel and the minor prophets, sometimes it's over economic injustice. You have unjust scales, and so you're ripping people off. And this makes God angry. That's economic injustice that God is talking about. So I think we have to just acknowledge that this matters. How does James define pure religion? It's taking care of the marginalized, the orphan, and the widow. Pure religion is caring for the marginalized. That's a New Testament text. So I think we have to say, let's come to grips here with what the Bible teaches about how we take care of the poor, the marginalized, or we might say the disenfranchised. God seems to care about these people groups in the Bible. Now we get into the second phase of your question, which I think is a little bit more tricky. So how do you now ferret between government obligations and church obligations? Some might push back on some of the things you said, that the government seems to do it so much better than the church does. There might be some who'd push back on that and say that, well, no, actually, sometimes these, the worst words that you want to hear is, hi, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Some will say some of those government interventions are not helpful and actually counterproductive to instilling good measures, and that under certain administrations, they'll look to community-based, faith-based community groups to be the sort of extension of the government and the application of aid to the poor, because they may do it better than government agencies may do it. So there might be some pushback there that you might just want to think through in terms of, as you look through this, what are solutions? Are they government solutions? Are they private sector solutions? Are they faith-based solutions? The third part to your question, how do we renew this, is I think it is incumbent upon the church to take James seriously. What does it mean to care for the widow and the orphan in the 21st century? So, one thing it means, who are the most vulnerable people right now in American society? The unborn are the most vulnerable people in American society right now. So the church has an obligation to care for the unborn, to speak up for the unborn. And that doesn't just mean protesting. It means, how are we helping young women, because they find themselves isolated mostly in these situations? How are we helping them in this crisis situation? So probably every church should have a crisis pregnancy center on their home mission list of receiving donations and funds. So that's one thing I'd say as we think about this. If we're talking about applying James today, we need to think, where is the most vulnerable group in our culture? Secondly, then, who else is vulnerable? Urban poor are vulnerable. I think about what my kids have. They have books in the house. Our house is full of books. They have nutritious food, but they always sneak off. My boys sneak to 7-Eleven and buy big gulps. But they have nutritious food in the house. They have clean air. They walk down the sidewalk in our neighborhood. They're likely not going to step on a needle. And they won't have to step over a condom either. So I think, yeah, that's a different context that my kids have. And so that means kids who are in a different context are vulnerable. And so how does the church reach out to the vulnerable and minister to the vulnerable and care for the vulnerable? I think that's incumbent on churches to think this through. How do we look at who, and widows and orphans are still in our day vulnerable, so we don't discard them. But I'm saying in that first century context, let's apply that to a 21st century context, and let's ask, who are the vulnerable, marginalized, disenfranchised people, and what is the church doing to help them? Those are good questions to ask. And if we ask them from two vantage points, number one, every single human being is in the image of God and therefore has dignity, then we alone have an absolute standard from which we engage aid. Whereas a lot of non-Christian groups who do this, they don't have an absolute standard from which they engage aid and assistance. So number one, the image of God. And number two, It's an obligation. It's God's command. He's told us to do this. We should do this. That's why we should do this. And again, you get outside of a Christian worldview, you don't have those two things governing you as you try to do this stuff. So, I hope that helps.
Just kind of piggybacking off that question, where does liberation theology come into play with what you said? How, I know opponents like call it cultural Marxism and stuff like that. To what extent is that good or bad?
So this is never the substitute for the gospel. It's always the implication of the gospel. That's the first thing you have to say. In ultimate liberation theology, that becomes the substitution for the gospel. If a person is fed and is not given the gospel, you are not being kind to that person. You are being inhumane to that person. So we always have to see these things as implications of the gospel, never substitutes for the gospel. And I would say, if we're viewing them as platforms to get around eventually to giving the gospel, it's going to trip us up too. It is always because we believe in the proclamation of the gospel that we will also recognize that there are implications to the gospel. So we must always stress the proclamation of the gospel is the church's task. But then there are implications to what that looks like as the church lives out the gospel in the world. And that will keep us from that. But you see it. It's a subtle move. But the move really becomes this stuff substitutes for the gospel. There was a hand back. Yes. No, I hear you. So I think we have to have a good dose of Augustinianism back into the equation. And so we as individuals are at once sinners and at once justified. And we have to recognize that that is true on a microcosmic level of the individual, and it is true on the macrocosmic level of the church. And so there is a time in which that perfection will come on a microcosmic level and a macrocosmic level, but it's not now. And Augustine introduced this wonderful idea of understanding ourselves as a redeemed and sinful being as a Christian. So we need to remove the idol of perfection. And again, I would say, you know, there's a difference between biblical faithfulness and wanting to hear, "Well done, thou good and faithful steward." There's a difference between that and perfection. And so I would say let's avoid we just have to do it by avoiding the idol of perfection. And it really drives us back to grace. This is the amazing thing. So if you go outside of the Reformed circles, of course, one of the founders of the of a movement that is sort of contrary to the Reformed sense of things is John Wesley. And it's interesting to me that John Wesley stressed both two things that seem polar opposites: perfectionism and that you can lose your salvation. And you think, well, that strikes me as incongruent. But it makes perfect sense because there's an underlying dynamic there. And it's a lot of dependence upon us and a cooperation of us and grace. So if it's a cooperation of us and grace, then you better believe I can get myself up to perfection. If I work, strive, kick, scream, white knuckle it, I'll get there. But if it's up to me to cooperate, I can also drop the ball and I can fall out. Augustine recognizes it's not a cooperation. It's grace at work in you. And when you are redeemed, you are regenerated, you're given a new heart, you're given new eyes to see, you're given new ears to hear, but you're still peccator. You're still a sinner. And so I would Augustine's good in just about every conversation. So I would say let's go back to a good old Augustinian sense and let's avoid the idol of perfection. Another front row question.
Okay.
It's great.
What are some ways you can combat like a tendency to become cynical in the industry? My family's in Augustine,
Sure.
Augustine's fairly employed in the industry.
Yeah.
I can just feel my own cynical self.
Yeah. That's a beautiful question. I think for one thing, it's a great question. I think for one thing, we have to always come back to say what a privilege it is. What a privilege it is to be able to proclaim God's word. So we must be grateful. One of the things Bonhoeffer said while he was in prison, he said, "How can we do any of this unless we are basically a grateful people?" And I think that's true for Christians at every stage of in whatever they do. But I think it's especially true for people in the ministry. You have to constantly remind yourself, I just have to be grateful I'm getting to do this. That'll help. The second thing is you just also have to not be naive. People will eat you for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I don't know why people are so mean, but they are. And I don't know why they can overlook all their flaws in themselves but see the tiniest flaw in you as if it's under a magnifying glass. That's just human nature. People are fickle. They're fickle in the way they approach their leaders. They're cranky. They're inconsistent. They hold people to different standards they hold themselves to. So all those reasons mean that in ministry you're going to get chewed up a lot. You're going to be unappreciated a lot and underappreciated a lot. And I think you have to just realize it. And then you have to just recognize that if you're in this for the short term and you're counting the short term losses, you're likely going to throw in the towel. But if you slog through it and recognize you're in this for the long term, it can be an incredibly rewarding thing. That people will see that and they will come around and follow a leadership in just remarkable ways and be very loving to people. Now, obviously in some situations there's bad issues, there's bad lay leadership, whatever, it's just not a general rule, not a cardinal rule. But there is a sense in which if you're in it for the long haul and you just love people back and forgive them back and recognize their weaknesses and imperfections, there could be down the road quite a harvest that's reaped of just a real joy in ministry. I saw it, and my dad growing up, he was a pastor, so I saw it. I saw people. We got anonymous letters. I remember my dad, he didn't know I was home, and he got an anonymous letter, left it on a thing. Somebody had cut out letters of a magazine and said, "The deacon's wife dresses, the head of your deacon board's wife dresses like a teenager. When are you going to do something about it?" And I walked by, so on the coffee table. It shattered my image of the church. I was 10 years old. But it's just going to happen. And, you just have to flog it out. And God will be gracious. And He'll give you joy amidst all of it. So. One more. Oh, yeah. No, I hear you. We always have to be careful. You hear this saying, Christians are the only ones that like to shoot their own wounded, you know, kind of a thing. And we do like to attack ourselves, and we're not always, sometimes we are our worst enemy. I think it's a fine line between being appropriately critical and knowing when the context is appropriate to be critical. I think when we are public facing, we should be very careful in the criticisms we put out there. For instance, I thought there was just a lot of distasteful things said about Billy Graham by some Christians when he died. It's like, we all know what Graham's shortcomings were. He wasn't the most dot the I's, cross the T's theologian when he would preach his sermons. We know that. Do we have to say that? You know? So I think we just have to be careful and think, what is the context? Wisdom calls us. There is this idea of being wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove. So we have to be aware of contexts and show some wisdom. But at the same time, I think we have to call things for what they are. And so when we see things, and we can offer a healthy criticism, we can offer. But it's no different than the context of church discipline. If we are ultimately in this for restoration, and our motive is not simply to put down, to make ourselves feel better, or to make ourselves look better, if our motive is truly to be after biblical faithfulness together, then that's a God-honoring motive. We may not always execute the motive in God-honoring means, so I get that, but we at least need to have the right motive. And if we have the right motive, then I think we can push on some of those things. What I've found, though, is that sometimes those criticisms are not the right motive. They really are intended to put some other ministry down or some other church down for the sake of putting in self-promotion and self-aggrandizement. And there's no place for that whatsoever. So I'd say be wise, be careful, of the context. You raise some good points, and we should be mindful of that. We're not really helping ourselves if we're feeding our critics fodder. But I could see in the right way, and if it's handled properly and it's done in love with a view to pushing us to biblical faithfulness, can be healthy.